tonight on Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. From the hit Netflix documentary, we have directors of Wild Wild Country, McLean and Chapman Way, at the top of the show. And from the first ever Northside Wedding Expo on April 15th, we have Melissa, Adrian, and Paige telling us all about it. With Chicago's Rum Fest coming to town, we have Jim Powers from Parse Rum. And at one, we have comedian Vic Pandya. And of course, riding sidecar tonight, we have our pop culture expert, Mr. John Tatey. But now, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio here in Chicago, it's time for Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez.
Let's get started, because we have some guests on the line, and this is a Netflix documentary series that came to... Look, we do a segment every Friday night called Binging on Cork. We've been suggesting shows that you should be binging on. And then one night, John Tatey comes in. He's like, are you watching Wild Wild Country? And I said, no. And then he said, you must. And so I did. I'm three episodes in. Joining us on the line are the directors, McLean and Chapman Way. And John Tatey did introduce me to this, you guys, but I'm all in. I'm on the third episode. And oh my God, I can't... I have to rewind every... I keep rewinding going, I'm sorry, what happened? Wait, there's a laboratory? They're carrying assault rifles?
Yeah,
okay.
Just starting to heat up for you. Thanks for having us on. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for taking the time. John Tatey explained this to me, and I don't think any description really does it any justice. He said, have you heard of this cult that came into Oregon? They built a town that was ready for 10 to 15, 20,000. They were building these buildings. And I was like, yeah, whatever, John.
Well, I was just astonished that I didn't know about it, Patty.
Exactly.
And for people who don't know, it's a 6-episode series. It's on Netflix. It's about this Rajneesh commune that took over a small town in Oregon in the 80s. That description doesn't even start to capture the madness of it. But it gets at so many salient issues. It gets at the sort of disorienting effect of a personality cult. It gets at the limits of our tolerance in America for religious and ethnic diversity. It gets at the disturbing consequences of Second Amendment taken to its fullest extent, right? And I just could not believe I hadn't heard this story before. How did you guys come across it in the first place?
Yeah, so kind of the way that you described it in the beginning was kind of how it was first kind of pitched to us. We had wrapped up a documentary in 2014 called The Battered Bastards of Baseball. We were working really closely with a film archivist in Portland, Oregon, and he asked us what we were doing next, and we didn't really have too many firm plans. And then he kind of just laid out the story of Rajneesh Perm for us. It's this Indian guru and his followers. They buy this 64,000-acre ranch. They spend $100 million building this utopia. They take over this neighboring town. They bust in 5,000 homeless people. You know, they poison 751 people. And to be honest, we were kind of like questioning him more than the story, because we just couldn't really believe that this had all happened. It was one of those things where we just felt like if it had happened, we would have known about it. But quickly kind of started Googling around and also digitizing all this footage he had. It was, we ended up with almost 300 hours of archival footage on this kind of like largely forgotten, but very fascinating story. And then, yeah, like you said, those themes, kind of testing tolerance for people that are coming into their neighborhoods and taking over. And, you know, this is ostensibly a peace-loving meditation group that arms themselves with AK-47s and there's voter residency requirement issues and land use issues and the difference between cult and religion. So we were just really fascinated to kind of tell this in like a long form, 6-part documentary series, and really excited that Netflix was able to that we were able to partner with them on it.
Well, and I'm stupefied every time the camera goes to people who were there at the time, every time you guys are interviewing either one of the followers or someone from the town. I mean, everyone is they're so reasonable, right? And you're listening to them the lawyer who was a part of the lawyer,
he's great.
Oh my God.
He was pretty solid.
And then, but then Sheila, I mean, I'm mesmerized by her. And then by the townspeople who are like, you know, and then these folks come in and everyone just seems reasonable. And I get every single side of it, kinda.
Yeah.
Which makes
sense. Oddly, that was kind of our experience in making this was, you know, we would have like hours long discussions amongst ourselves. And, you know, it took us about 4 years to make, but, you know, especially during production and editing, you know, our own positions would evolve on this topic and kind of switch back and forth. But, you know, we would spend 5 days interviewing a former ranch member, and, you know, you'd walk away kind of really buying into this idea that this was kind of government overreach and religious persecution of a minority group. And then we'd spend 5 days with kind of an antelopian rancher that had to live next to this kind of commune or cult, and they'd talk to you about how destructive this was in their lives. So I think that we are definitely interested in kind of the long-form documentary format, exploring all those different perspectives.
And you know what, guys? That really comes through in the series, because this is an amazing story, but as a critic, I've seen plenty of amazing stories that falter in the telling. And this is an amazing story, really well told. And I think it's because of what you were just talking about, that you can tell that you guys did not come to this with all the answers, and you want us as viewers to go through that same journey. We don't get jerked around from side to side, but it's just a constantly evolving picture, and it's just such a pleasure to take it in and think about the consequences that you sort of lay out with what I would characterize as a gentle touch. There's not a lot of there's no narration, and there's not a lot of imposition of the directors on this series. Did you have that in mind going in, or is that an approach that evolved as you went?
Yeah, I think we're definitely interested in that going in. I think, you know, the way we consume media and news and politics today, you know, we just have such a like knee-jerk reaction to want to know, like, who's right, who's wrong, and, like, where do I fall on this issue? And, you know, this story was so complex when we pitched it to Netflix. We told them, like, look, this is not a traditional true crime narrative. It's not a whodunit. It's not based on who's guilty and what's the evidence. It's really like a thought experiment. It's an exploration into these two different communities, and we're going to dive deep and pull back, you know, the political and social layers of this era in American history. And lucky enough, you know, Netflix was really on board with us to do that. And so we were just really eager to have an audience like dive in and engage with these issues and do some real critical thinking before they end up with their opinions and how they feel about these issues.
Again, this is amazing. We're talking to filmmakers McLean and Chapman Way, who have brought to life this moment in American history that is astounding. And anyone who watches it, I just don't know how to explain it to you. We're not spoiling anything, but this is on Netflix. There are 6 episodes to this. And as you watch it, it just seems so impossible. When you learned, obviously there's so much footage, right? Because the folks from this cult were taking, first of all, they were taking...
They taped everything, right?
Well, they were also taping the townspeople as a way to intimidate them, too. Like, we're watching you, which got very strange, but it was also an interesting sort of a revenge moment for them. But the escalation was the part where I kept going back and forth on. I had to rewind and watch again, and the next thing I know, there's like the creator of Nike in the middle of it. I'm like, what just happened? Do you have something that surprised you the most? And without spoiling it for people who obviously are going to get into this this documentary, what along the way surprised you the most? Chapman, I'll go with you first.
Yeah, sure. I think the most interesting thing I found is like how far like really thoughtful, intelligent people will go to defend their ideologies and defend their communities if they feel like they're under attack. And it's very easy to dismiss religious minority groups or cults. But oftentimes they do feel under an intense persecution from politically and socially. And so it was really interesting interviewing Ma Nanchila, who was the head of this entire movement, and listening to her kind of justification of what led her to these criminal actions. And I think it's really terrifying when you hear a really logical step-by-step approach to what leads someone into madness.
I agree. How about you, McLean?
Yeah, mine's maybe a little bit more specific. I just kind of have this very specific memory of interviewing the Deputy Attorney General of Oregon, and I won't spoil it too much, but there's this part where beavers get introduced to the story. suffice to say, things don't end up too well for these beavers, and it's kind of a part of this larger plan to poison more people. And it just didn't really come across in our research, and I think that he was probably saving it for the interview day. I don't know. But anyway, he leans into this story and just kind of rattles off very nonchalantly a very shocking thing that happened to these beavers. And Chaps, my brother, and he kind of shot the whole documentary, and I did most of the interviews. And it was kind of this moment where after the interview, we told the story, Chap and I just kind of looked at each other, and it was just eye contact. It was like no words, but we were both thinking the same same thing. It was pretty much along the lines of like, what the F? Like, what the F did I just hear? That's kind of it's the censored version of what you're thinking.
It's one of a number of surreal moments in the course of the series.
Yeah.
There is all this footage of the commune, right? And they seem to have videotaped everything. How did you guys get access to these tapes? And how on earth did you sort through it all? It's such a treasure. I imagine that the production work of it must have been pretty daunting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's actually really rare because, you know, the story starts in 1981, right when kind of local news stations were switching from 16-millimeter film, where they would only, you know, film a couple of minutes of footage for each evening broadcast, to where they switched to U-matic tape in the early 80s. And so these local news stations would go out to this commune and just shoot hours and hours of tape because tape was so cheap. And even back then, a lot of news stations would film over their U-matic tapes to save money on tape stock. But, you know, these news managers understood at the time that this was such like a significant American story that was unfolding, that they decided to archive all these raw tapes that the cameraman had shot. So in a way, it's almost like an archival verite doc, because we were working with this incredibly intimate, you know, archive footage that was unedited and raw from that time period.
So this is footage that you got from news producers. I assume that a lot of it came from footage that had been shot by the Reichsnischis themselves.
Yeah, a lot of it came from the group. The guru was kind of like a real believer in using video technology to spread his message. So they would make these short documentaries and then ship them out to all their satellite communes around the world to help raise money, to help raise awareness for their religion. And so he was definitely a big believer in the power of media, and that, you know, all good media coverage is good media coverage.
There's so many things that are mind-blowing in this, and many what the F moments. But I thought there was also, I mean, there's so much logic on both sides, including the idea that there have been many communities across this country that have started as a religious movement, whether it's the Amish. I think that even talking about how the Catholics in Boston had control over, you know, politics and law enforcement.
Right. Yeah.
You talk about Salt Lake City, or even just the state of Utah that continues to be.
That was such a fascinating monologue by the lawyer that you're talking about.
That was one of the most interesting components, was this kind of church and state issue that pops up in episode 3. And, you know, the really complex thing about the separation of church and state is that it's, you know, it's a two-pronged law, which is, on one hand, it's to prevent religions from controlling government, but on the flip side, it's also to prevent government intrusion on religious groups. And so listening to these two sides use the Constitution as both like a weapon and a shield for their own community survival was really fascinating to us. And both sides were so certain that they were on the right side of the Constitution.
And that was the thing. So that the Constitution to me goes all the way back to the very beginning, because Sheila is like, you know, I know the United States. I know their Constitution. I know how we can make this work. Did you ever have a moment where you sit back and went, I wonder if people just hadn't messed with them, if they hadn't pushed back on this community, what that would have looked like in Oregon, if they would have gone to the extent that they did?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what's interesting is you're kind of asking yourself throughout this series, like, if they had just been left alone, like, would this group resorted to the tactics that they did? And, you know, my personal opinion is that they did not move to Oregon to poison 750 people and to try and assassinate, you know, the U.S. attorney of the District of Oregon. You know, these were kind of like the really tragic side effects of like this paranoia and pressure that was circulating within this religious community.
Yeah. John.
Guys, this is my $1 million question, and I'm so excited that I get to ask you this. What? I'm watching the series, and the question I'm left with is, what the heck was it about this guy, Osho, that made him so magnetic to these people? I can see why they would be attracted to the way of life. I can see why they would be attracted to some of the ideas. But whenever we see Osho in action, and granted, he's silent for a large part of the story, he just seems like kind of a vain doofus to me. And Sheila is the one with the energy and the just incredible charisma. What do you think people saw in Osho? The lawyer in particular seems especially enamored with just being in his presence.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's a question that we asked ourselves constantly. And we would ask, you know, current and former members of this group to try to explain to us. And I think at a certain point, this was kind of, you know, when a lot of these people first joined this movement, before Roshni's term, they went to Pune, India. And this was kind of at the very end of 1960s counterculturalism. I think that they had a deep kind of disillusionment with the direction of the country. It's not too different than I think some of the situations that people feel about where we are today. Yeah. But they were seekers, you know, that's what they identified as. That was a core part of their identity and who they believed. So there was kind of this Eastern migration of Westerners to India. And I think that Bhagwan was able to carve himself out as very different than other gurus who were preaching the rejection of desire and the rejection of wealth and food and sex. And Bhagwan said you can have it all and still become enlightened. And I think that was incredibly appealing and attractive to successful Westerners who got to keep the, you know, who didn't need to be kind of ashamed of their wealth, but also got to feel like they were walking a path of enlightenment. And so, but I think what's interesting is as it did come to the ranch, what you said is spot on. Bhagwan takes this vow of silence. And so then when we would ask people, well, when he wasn't talking, what was the attraction? What was the appeal of this? And really, I think whether they admitted it openly or not, what they would talk about is just kind of like the power of community and family that they felt out there. I think a common theme among a lot of followers were these were people that didn't have the happiest of childhoods, or there was a void there, there was something missing. A lot of them grew up in highly religious households, whether they were strictly Catholics or Mormons or evangelical Christians, and then kind of broke away from that, but still kind of wanted devotion and faith in their life. So it was a lot of different answers, but I think that towards the ranch, I think why they became so committed to defending not just Bhagwan, but the community, was because they really felt like that had become their kind of eternal home.
I should let the listeners know that Osho and Bhagwan, this is the same person we're talking about.
Right.
They are. Sorry, names. I don't. I got it. Am I using them interchangeably? I used to get so frustrated.
No, I was.
Sorry. Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry.
I've seen three episodes, and I'm still trying. I'm like, what, wait, which one's which? And I just know Sheila. Yeah. By the way, I don't know if you know who played Vern in Stand By Me, but he posted about this last night that for Halloween he wants to go to Goodwill and buy all the maroon and pink and purple clothing.
And I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, you have to check it out. So I tweeted at him. I'm like, you should call in tonight. And someone else posted they want to be Sheila for Halloween. But I think that this is the kind of attention and that you guys deserve. I mean, beyond that, such incredible filmmaking. Congratulations on this.
Yeah.
And I can't thank you enough for doing this and clearly putting in so much of every side of this. A moment in history that I just didn't know about. I was too young, but even I asked my mom and she does not really remember this. And clearly it was covered on national news. Go ahead.
Yeah, it kind of oddly stayed within Oregon, and that was definitely what kind of attracted us to telling the story. Mm. But it feels great to hear that. I mean, honestly, this was something that we spent the better part of 3 or 4 years working on, and the last 3 weeks have been amazing, kind of watching it kind of launch on Netflix and listening to people deeply engaged in the series. It honestly was not something we were expecting that much of, and so it's just been an absolute thrill for us.
That's great. You deserve it. It's a really special series. It's
yes.
Wild, Wild Country on Netflix, if you're listening
again,
out there.
Yes.
Check it out.
Wild, Wild Country. And I got to go back and see, what is it called? Battered Bastards? I don't know the other one. I love baseball. However, I've got to find this one too. So
it's on Netflix. It was a Netflix doc in 2014. It's a fun one too. It's Oregon based too. So
okay.
You're going to be an Oregon history buff pretty soon once you're done with our documentary.
Well, yeah, I'm going to be thirsty for something. So I look forward to that because you have that sort of letdown when you finish something that you really have gotten into. And so I'm glad that you've got other work out there for us to find. Where can people find out more about you in particular and the work that you're doing?
You know what? We don't really have kind of a place for that so much.
Good
we're
for
a little
you.
Bit.
They're just small, artists.
Yeah, we're a little bit of a small team, and my brother and I make our documentaries together. Chaff's wife Juliana is our producer, and we kind of tend to make these things a little bit just in our bedrooms. And then we've just been fortunate to always have kind of Netflix there for us to kind of launch these things out. We're working on some more documentary series, kind of as we speak. It's an exciting genre. We never expected it after features to jump right into series, but it's a big canvas, and it's, as a filmmaker, you're kind of thrilled with the amount of space you're given to play with stories in that.
Well, thank you for playing, because this is amazing. And again, Wild, Wild Country. John and I cannot recommend this more. And I know Michael has seen this. And again, it's incredible. And thank you. If you guys are coming through Chicago at all, we'd love to have you in studio.
Oh, that'd be a blast.
Please. Be well, you guys. Looking forward to all the other work that you have to come and what you've already done. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us on again, guys.
Oh, our pleasure. Thank you again. That was McLean and Chapman Way. See their series, Wild Wild Country, playing now on Netflix. More in a moment on 720 WGN. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with McLean and Chapman Way. They are the filmmakers who did the series, the documentary series on Netflix, Wild Wild Country. Before we get to our next guest to talk about the first ever Northside Wedding Expo coming up on April 15th, I know that Julie wanted to make a comment about this documentary. Hey, Julie, how are you doing?
Hi. It wasn't this documentary, Patty, but my sister told me she watched a series on Netflix. And she said, believe it or not, I think you might like it. And when I found out what it was about, I said, that's nothing like me. I would never like something like that. Yeah, I know. And she said, just watch one episode.
Okay.
I watched one episode, then I watched 17 more.
Oh, boy.
What was it?
Yeah.
It's a biker gang. They smoke. They do everything. They kill. But they protect their own. And it shows you how about their lives and how much they love each other and their family and how they protect each other.
Was it the series Sons of Anarchy or was it a documentary?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Sons of Anarchy. And it is crazy good. And when I go to her house, I can't wait to see it because I can't get Netflix for some reason. But anyway, I love your show. And I just, when I was listening to that, how you watched three episodes and you kind of got you.
Yeah.
I know what you're saying, and it's amazing.
Well, being a former Mormon, I get uncomfortable with like watching people kind of get glazed over and buying into something, but it's compelling and it's wonderful. It's really well done, so I highly recommend it, Julie.
And Sons of Anarchy is good too. Not a documentary, though. I will remind the listeners.
Yes.
Yeah. No. It's a series. But thank you.
Thank you, Julie.
Thanks, Julie.
Be safe. Have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
You too. Bye bye.
Bye-bye. With joining us in the studio, John, I don't know how you prepared for your wedding after you got engaged. Where did you get married?
New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire? Mm-hmm. Did you get, like, wedding planners? Did you go to any expos or anything like that?
Nah.
I have to say,
sorry, ladies.
No, I did not either. And there were a few things that fell through the cracks for me when I was getting married. And I think that it was partly just kind of wanting to get it over with. But I think that I didn't have a chance to kind of have some of the fun and also to learn more about what my options were. So joining me in studio, I want to talk to our guests who are going to be a part of the first ever Northside Wedding Expo on April 15th, introducing engaged couples to the wonderful eclectic Edgewater. Joining us from the Edgewater Chamber of Commerce is Melissa. So what's the sort of genesis behind this expo?
Sure. So in the last year, we've had a couple of venues open up. Recently, we had the historic Colvin House at Sheridan and Thorndale open up. It laid dormant forever. It's a historic mansion. People have, I think, in the last 2 years, been able to tour it through Open House Chicago, and has now open for actual business. It's a co-working space upstairs, and then downstairs is an event space, and is so beautiful. They did a wonderful job respecting its history, but then still updating it where they could.
Uh-huh.
And then additionally, we had the Lytle House, which just opened up south of Bryn Mawr on Broadway. You will note that it has a Dolly Parton mural straight on the gate, and it's amazing.
On the gate?
It's so
That's
great.
Bold.
And it's like when you enter into like their front lawn, essentially, you completely forget that you are on Broadway and that there is so much traffic kind of just parallel to you. It really has this wonderful way of escaping the actual city. It has a beautiful mural on the side of the wall. So just really awesome hidden gem right on Broadway. And then obviously Firehouse Chicago has been open for multiple years. So we're kind of seeing this nice trend of opening up venue spaces in the area. And when we were talking to some of these ladies as they're, you know, getting ready to open up their businesses, we had a lot of great response of vendors wanting to kind of participate in this kind of expo. And so had a great response and we decided to go for it.
I absolutely adore the idea of being able to get married in your community. Like if there had been a destination in Jefferson Park or Norwood Park or Edison Park that was kind of like, I mean, maybe there was and I just didn't, again, I didn't seek things out, but to have this sort of event where people can find out what's right there. And so if you're inviting people from out of town, you're like, this is my neighborhood.
Yeah.
This is my part of Chicago. So we also have Paige from Firehouse. Tell us a little bit about how you guys are involved in this event.
I actually just started at Firehouse Chicago recently, and my first interaction with the chamber, with the Edgewater Chamber and Melissa, was planning the expo. I was so excited to come into a community that not only has other venues and vendors right within the neighborhood, but also a community that supports and wants to book local and plan their entire wedding local.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I had to go all the way out to the suburb. I went to my husband's part of the neck of the woods instead of staying by in my neighborhood. This is fantastic. And tell, like, how long has Firehouse been in the community?
So Firehouse Chicago was built in 1903. We're older than Wrigley Field and older than the Adler Planetarium. Firehouse.
Oh. Take that, Wrigley.
Yeah.
The Firehouse with engine number 70 closed down in 2008. It was purchased by some really cute, eclectic, artsy owners who completely rehabbed it and kept the original character to it. Originally, they were going to use it as their production company and production studio, but after a couple years in 2013, they decided to open it up as a wedding venue as well.
That's spectacular. And joining us as well, we have Adrian from Dovetail, and we're big fans of Dovetail here at Pretty Late.
Oh, to,
come closer to your microphone so All we can right, hear your lovely
yeah.
voice, and tell us a little bit about what you want to show off as part of the expo.
Well, we are definitely going to showcase our beer, which is super delicious. We specialize in continental European style, so we'll be pouring it at the expo.
Uh-huh.
And we
you specialize in continental what style?
European
style, so like German, Belgian, Polish,
oh, and the
Czech
wines.
Styles.
I thought
the beers. The
yeah.
beers. So we have so
the beers. The beers.
Yes.
Right.
The beers.
Yeah.
The beers. Yeah.
Boy, I'm doing a great job with this. Sorry to interrupt. I just pictured like a continental wave. Forget it. Go.
You're
ahead.
Fine. You're doing absolutely fine.
That's
well, because people think about at going to a wedding reception. Because I was very specific in my choices at my wedding. Right. Because I'm Irish and Mexican. My husband is Irish and Welsh. So for our cocktail choices, we only had Irish and Mexican beers and a margarita maker. Because otherwise, like, if you give people too many choices, it gets kind of crazy. So it's nice to have a specialized idea, and here's a local brewery, and what they have to offer is wonderful.
So, yeah, so we're offering our beer at the expo to try, and we also have a beautiful event space. We call it our barrel loft.
Mm-hmm.
So you can party up among the lambic barrels. So the lambic
Ooh.
Style beer is a Belgian style, and it ages in barrels for 2 years or a little bit longer, maybe. And it's a beautiful backdrop to a great party.
Oh, that's
just the sound of it. I want to
yeah,
party there. Yeah,
we do low key weddings, fancy weddings. It's just a really fun party.
Now again, we're talking to our friends from the first ever Northside Wedding Expo, which is going to be on Sunday, April 15th. That's this Sunday, beginning at 11 a.m. There's going to be a VIP fashion show with mimosas and small batch donuts at the Colvin House, and then from noon to 5, there's going to be a general expo. This is going to be at at three locations in Edgewater. There's going to be transportation between venues provided by Chicago Trolley and Double Decker Company. Where can people get tickets for this, Melissa?
Edgewater.org.
Edgewater.org. Let's find out more about all these great spots where people are going to be getting more information on how they can plan their weddings in Edgewater right there on the lakefront. I mean, this is brilliant. I'm so excited for this. Yeah. More after this on 720 WGN. I honestly don't even think you need to be getting married to go on this this wedding expo.
No. Well Patty.
Yes.
I was just looking at my info sheet here. 11 a.m. on Sunday. VIP fashion show. Now, I know I don't look at ladies right now, but I do love fashion. Mimosas and small batch donuts. I think I might show up to this thing.
I'm saying this sounds fantastic. And it is a wedding expo, so it's not things have gotten so much better when it comes to involving both people in the planning of a wedding. Both partners showing up, making decisions. So I love that part of it too. Tell us a little bit about what people can expect. Let's say, Melissa, from the fashion show, as
sure.
John mentioned.
So the fashion show starts at, like you just said, at 11 o'clock at the Colvin House. And we have one of the workers out of the co-working space out of the Colvin House. It's a lot of C's. is Avail & Co. She makes custom bridal dresses. And we had, we'll also be using Salon Echo for hair and makeup. We were having
having the, like, basically the dry run of the fashion show, like, last night. And can I tell you, there's also, like, a teeny tiny four-year-old who's also part of the fashion show,
nice.
Which is amazing.
Aww.
But it was really awesome to see all the models kind of get together, try on the dresses, and see, like, you know, how we're going to use the space. And just different styles of dresses, I think, is one of the really awesome things to see. A lot of different, we were laughing at the varying heights of the models as well, mm-hmm. different body types. And again, I mean, Rachel from Avail & Co, she does all custom work. So it's great where it's, you know, obviously very personalized to you, what you want, your size, and all that great stuff. So that will be the fashion show. And then obviously we'll have that sparkling wine and donuts from Edge of Sweetness Bakery, also in Edgewater, and then swag bags for everyone.
Edge of Sweetness, because that was my next question. Where can I get these donuts?
Yes.
If I can't make the fashion show.
And I was fortunate enough to go hang out at their bakery for like an hour and a half while they were making them, because I was like, I need to take video of you guys making these donuts social media for the wedding expo.
Well, I bet you
come on in.
I'll bet you they pair very well with some of the beer from Dovetail. And and so excited for everybody. Let's take a break here to find out a little bit more when we come back. Again, this is the first ever Northside Wedding Expo on April 15th. You in Edgewater, by the way. You can go to brownpapertickets.com, look for the event, or go to the edgewater.org/Northside-wedding-guide for more information. More in a moment on 720 WGN. Coming up on April 14th, there's an event that Esmeralda and I have had the pleasure of enjoying at the Logan Square Auditorium, is the 4th annual Chicago Rum Festival. Esmeralda, I believe we were in attendance for that one last year.
Yes, we were.
It was fantastic. And there were so many booths, so many people who are well-versed in not just rum in general, but obviously a lot of folks who work for companies that produce those spirits, and sharing the sort of, there's a celebration of rum. And we have with us Jim Powers from Parse Rum, and he has set up a display, has lit this up, almost like to taunt me, because we're not drinking on the air, and we've got this very well lit up. Tell us a little bit about Parse Rum.
It's a little teaser.
Yeah.
Actually, it's called the Parse, but
I apologize.
Worries. It's a P-A-R-C-E, so it's a common thing. Basically, Parse, to begin with, the word is a Medellin, Colombia slang term for buddy or pal. Mm-hmm. Hey, Parse, let's go get a drink. Hey, Parse, ¿qué pasa? So we wanted to create something that had kind of a more of a laid back kind of feel, you know, easy experience kind of thing. So it's a rum from Colombia.
Okay.
Created with my brothers and a friend of ours from Colombia, so there's four of us involved, and a number of family and friends. So if it doesn't succeed, we have many long Thanksgivings ahead of us.
And how does one decide that they're just going to create a rum?
You know, it was very much, I have a brother who lives in Medellin, and I went down there with another brother, and for the first time, was blown away by the country, the beauty of the land, the friendliness of the people.
Mm-hmm.
I was really taken by it, and real optimism these days. So it became this thing of what can we do down here to kind of maybe be a bridge between the Columbia we're experiencing and, you know, today's world.
Right.
So my brothers and I, as Irish Americans, like a good spirit, a good whiskey or scotch here and there. And we were tasting some good rums, and we thought, you know, this is really a marvel for us, a new experience, that rum can be this complex and this interesting. So that kind of started this whole odyssey of, been in about 6 years of finding the right blenders for our rum. We found a father-son duo from Bogota who've been in the rum business for 50 years.
Uh-huh.
They sent us several blends of rum. Once we got a thumbs up from some people who really know rum, we've learned a lot in the last 7 years. But when the experts kind of gave us a thumbs up and we all liked it, of course, we went to market.
How do you explain to people that they don't have to just put it in Diet Coke?
Yeah, well, you know, it's pretty funny.
It is. I mean, it's the one thing that nobody seems to sip.
So true. I mean, I think for most Americans, probably myself included, rum brings to mind maybe a bad spring break experience, right?
Oh, gosh.
Right?
Sure.
Or something you mask with juices or things to kind of almost cover the flavor. But when you find in Latin America and in the cultures where sugar cane is prevalent, is there's varied degrees of quality the same mm-hmm. way with any spirit. And so really it's about having a taste. The best thing you can do is let your own senses pick up on what a real quality rum is, which also ties in well with this rum fest that's coming up, because you have the chance to sip a variety of rums neat. They're tiny little tastes. You know, you you get to just get your nose on it, get a little taste, but you get the chance to compare and see, you know, you develop a profile of what you think is interesting.
I have to agree. Esmeralda, what was your, we had a few favorites. I know it's been a year and I didn't do a good job. I took all these cards from a lot of the folks that were working in the booth. Do you remember any of the favorites that you had? Because we were trying it both straight and mixed.
Yeah, I enjoyed Stolen.
Stolen
rum.
Oh,
sure.
There
you go. That's a really tasty rum, actually. I think it was originally from New Zealand.
Okay.
And now I think they've moved to the States, but it's a cool concept.
It is a very fun event, too. Were you there last year?
Oh, we sure were, yeah. It was
Chaotic.
It was chaotic, but what
but fun.
You find
it was like controlled chaos.
Totally. And it was about people that had a genuine interest and curiosity about, you know, what they're enjoying, what they're experiencing, a lot of great conversations.
Absolutely.
We really enjoyed it. And we got a lot of good new Parsley fans along as well. So it was kind of a win-win for everybody. It really was a fun event.
It is. It's a lot of fun. Again, this event is on Saturday, April 14th at Logan Square Auditorium, which is located at 2539 North Kedzie Boulevard right here in Chicago. And I'm trying to find you go to therumlab.com, by the way, for ticket information. It was packed last year. So if you're interested in doing this, I recommend that you go ahead and get your tickets because it was crowded. Although last year, wasn't it very warm out? Like it was very cozy in that auditorium.
Yeah, I remember it being much warmer than it is now.
Yeah, so by Saturday, I don't think it's going to warm up much, so you'll be able to cuddle with people and your tastes of rum.
There you go, and the rum will help keep you warm, too.
Exactly. So you have three bottles here for Parsley rum.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about the differences, because I'm guessing there's
We have a three-year, an eight-year, and a 12-year rum expressions, and basically that refers to the amount of time that the rum is aged in whiskey barrels.
Okay.
Our rum is aged and used bourbon barrels, predominantly Jack Daniel's barrels. And so what you'll find is different characteristics by the sugarcane distillate aging in char American oak barrels changes the character of the rum. Mm-hmm. It changes the flavors, the notes you may get on the finish. For example, a three-year, unsurprisingly, is going to have a little warmer finish on the back end. Works really well with cocktails, maybe multi-layered juices and things.
Okay.
That little bit of heat adds a nice structure to the cocktail. Where your eight-year, a little bit mellower. Maybe you're pulling out a little more notes of cherry, but still just a tinge of warmth. And you move up to the 12-year. We hear a lot of the 12-year tends to be more almost cognac-like, a little softer, rounder finish, notes of creme brulee, but all without adding any spices. This is just the interaction of the sugarcane distillate resting in a char oak barrel for 3, 8, or 12 years.
That's quite the story of each one, too. And
yeah.
And which one, now, are all these ones that you would recommend just sipping, or more the older barrel, aged
barrel?
Well,
you know what? It really depends upon your personal preference. I mean, I think that to just learn about them, I would initially have a small sip of each, right? Because then your senses are going to pick up on the differences. I mean, I can talk about how they're different, but there's nothing like, you know, getting a nice nose on it and having a nice sip and determining your own, making your own mind. But we find that the 12-year, for example, is really nice in just a snifter. You have it maybe after a nice multi-course meal. None of our rums have any additives. It's very straightforward, very complex, and a little drier finish. This is not your like I said, your university or college memories of rum. This is really a complex, fulfilling spirit.
Well, you bring up a good point, because the other thing that goes along with being younger or perhaps not getting out of some sort of a rhythm of thinking that you're of chasing a drunk, of you know, trying to like drink to get drunk fast and then pass the point of being able to be in control of yourself. This is about enjoying the taste.
It really
and
is.
Drinking responsibly.
No, that's a really good point. I mean, I think that one of the things we're drawn to this is that, you know, you sip it, you nurture it. It's not about slamming anything.
Right.
It's really about just kind of relaxing and enjoying the nuance of something that's been, you know, part of civilization since the beginning of man, right? I mean, it's...
We've always been going after fermented foods.
We have always, whatever culture you go at any latitude, someone's fermenting something. And I think it's been that way since the beginning of time.
Even in the wild, animals, you know, go after the fermented fruit as well.
Absolutely. I've seen those baboon videos, right?
I think, sure. I can't remember, there was an extraordinarily large animal that had found something like in a tree, and like they were so drawn to the smell of the fermented fruit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. pretty wild.
Yeah, we're always trying to find that. But again, it's meant to take the edge off, to relax, as you mentioned.
For sure.
And to appreciate the way it's made. We are hanging out with our friend Jim Powers. He's here with Parse Rum. The fourth annual Chicago Rum Festival is this Saturday at Logan Square Auditorium. Go to therumlab.com to find out more about the event. And again, there are two sessions. There's one from 12:30 to 5:30. You have different levels of the pass. Oh, it's between 12:30 and 5:30. So I'm guessing that those are divided up like from...
Yes, I think the way it is, there's a general admission that is from 3:30, I believe. Let me take a double check. Yeah, 3:30 to 6:30 is a general admission. I think you can get in at 2:30. It might be a little higher ticket price for a VIP grand tasting session.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And then also, just for those who are like, you know, I'm kind of curious about this, but do I have to pay full price? They do have a designated driver, so
yes,
you can hang out with your, you know, come along, find out about the industry. Hey, you know, if you want to be the one that's going to give them a ride home, that's also available.
Yes.
From 3:30 to 6:30 for $10. It's a great mingling event too, having conversations with people, learning a little something. More with our guest Jim when we come back on 720 WGN. Joining us in studio is our friend Jim Powers from Parse Rum. Before we get back to our conversation, just remember, make the most of life after 50 with Prime Expo, the premier event for active adults on April 14th. Learn more at primeexpochicago.com. This Saturday, April 14th, is the fourth annual Rum Fest, brought to you by the Rum Lab. Go to therumlab.com. And again, this is at Logan Square Auditorium at 2539 North Kedzie Boulevard. I love the Logan Square neighborhood. Where are you from originally, Jim?
You know, Chicago is my home. I've been up near the Music Box for about 20 years now.
Really?
We're raising two kids here.
Where'd you go to high school?
Well, I went to high school out in the burbs. I went to Marmion.
Marmion?
Yeah, you familiar
with that? No, you're my first. Well, yes, I'm familiar with it, but you're my first Marmion.
Yes, I went to Marmion. I was actually raised in Iowa to 16. My last 2 years were at Marmion, and then pretty much I've moved a couple years here and there, but I keep coming back to Chicago.
You keep coming back here?
I do.
Yeah. Well, that's a great neighborhood too, the Music Box, that entire area, whether it's restaurants, the shops around there, it's grown so much.
Yeah, it's really been great, and it's been good place to raise the family, and you can walk to what you need. It's
sure.
Really, really, really enjoy it.
Now, are you finding when you're going out to kind of pitch Parse Rum, how is it getting local distribution?
You know what? It actually went pretty well. I mean, you do have to give yourself some time, but we presented to some people here, and we were well received. And you know, you roll out in a few restaurants, you know, a couple of Binnie's at first, mm-hmm. you know, we're at Binnie's and Whole Foods and other places, and then it moves from, you know, two or three, wherever they bring us in, we go pour some tastings, mm-hmm. let people taste it, see what it's about, and it just kind of expanded from there. So now we're in New York, Florida, California.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And we're in South Korea, China, Iceland, believe it or not. We're going to be in Italy, Denmark, and then we're spreading out through Latin America, Peru, Costa Rica. You know, it's all kind of going the right way.
Then are you seeing the growth? Because obviously there was kind of that tequila wave, right?
When
people,
yes.
I felt like Patron was sort of the beginning of people going, oh, tequila can taste okay.
Absolutely.
Right? And then you get the whiskey, the bourbon, and so rum seems like the one, like I mentioned at the beginning, is the mixer, right? But it seems like it's coming into its own now.
Well, you know, if you think about it, back to, you know, our parents' generation, but as I recall, you know, vodka or gin were initially mixers, right? And then you got into the Stolies, the Absolutes. Mm-hmm. So you see this segmentation where people start getting into the quality.
They had to flavor themselves in order to be interesting.
Well,
vodkas,
that's a good point, actually. No, it's very that is true. I think that then what followed was with tequilas and mezcals, and mm-hmm. now, really, if you think about it, rum is kind of the last major spirit group that has not had that kind of segmentation.
Yeah, so. The last thing in a Long Island.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Right.
Everybody else seems to have found their niche. But backtrack a little bit. For the 60-minute segment with the interview with Stormy Daniels, I had a dark and stormy sort of event. So
a little bit
of a theme party. But you know, I remember standing there trying to decide which rum. Friends of mine, like is it Puricana? Kanya. I can't remember the name.
Yeah, Florida Kanya.
Florida Kanya.
Yes,
that's
Nicaraguan.
What it is. Yeah. Yes, and I had been at their house one time while they were traveling, my friends Mark and Yenny, and I was like, oh, they have this lovely bottle. Well, it turned out it was an aged bottle.
Oh, okay.
That's very hard to come by. And it just never occurred to me. I was like, oh, I get, yeah. It's just sort of one of those things where it looks like all the other bottles.
Yes, of course.
But it now makes sense why they went down so smoothly.
Sure, no, right. Absolutely.
But it was when I started to learn that there are definitely, there's more beyond your, you know, Captain Morgan's and obviously
absolutely. And those are spiced rums where, right, you know, there's other components and additives added to the rum, which can, you know, is enjoyed by a lot of people. And then when you get into the more the aged spirits, the more kind of premium spirits, it's the aging process itself that brings out the different flavor notes. And that's more that sipping it neat, maybe having it on the rocks, that kind of experience.
I'm sorry, I'm getting text from somebody. And now I know why I know the school Marmion. Is that the military school all the way out in Aurora?
Yes, yeah,
all
absolutely.
Right. I knew it was familiar to me. So our regular White Sox Wednesday guest, John Bolger, is messaging us. I don't know if you know any of the Bolgers.
That name is very familiar.
Well, besides being their uncle was, or the great uncle was, Ray Bolger. So I'm sure one of your classmates would have been bragging about that well.
Yeah, for sure.
But so you were in military school and now you're selling rum, and I kind of love that.
And between that, I was in music. So, you know, just to keep it interesting.
It all goes together. What did the family think when you're like, we're going to start? I mean, I know that you're starting it also with your own family, but
yes, yeah,
you know, we're going into rum.
They were pretty behind it. I mean, I think just in general, you know, our father was an entrepreneur and before he passed, I know he always wanted us, the sons, to do something together. And we did. I was more into music. I had a couple of the brothers did get into the family business, but we all thought this was a great time for us to do this. So it's a cool family venture. Everyone's been completely behind it. It's really been very supportive and interesting. It's never dull.
No doubt about it.
Dull.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's not the, you know, embarking on a sort of adventure like this.
Yes.
You got everybody behind you on it. Yeah.
Well, you do. And something else that's really driven us is because we do have a brother in Colombia. I have nieces and nephews down there. But we really want to do, I love the whole Tom Shoe saying. I think their idea of, you know, giving back makes a lot of sense and is gratifying. We plant a tree in Colombia for every bottle we sell. It's native species trees. We visited the village where they're reforesting. They do have problems with overforestation in Colombia even. Mm-hmm. And so we've so far to date planted over 22,000 trees. And it's really had a nice kind of impact, you know, in some small way in the country, and we're going to keep doing that. So it's been a fun way to kind of engage with the people and the culture and you know, give back as well.
That's just fantastic. Again, we've been talking to Jim Powers from Parse Rum. You can meet Jim and learn more about Parse Rum and all the other rum providers and makers at the 4th Annual Chicago Rum Festival. Go to therumlab.com for more ticket information. Again, that's going to be on Saturday at Logan Square Auditorium, 2539 North Kedzie Avenue. Jim's looking at me. I'm just holding the bottle. You know, I'm not going to taste any, but I do want to smell it. I'm just like so tempted to.
There you go.
Oh, that smells nice. And I do. I like. And when it comes down to even choosing the type of bottle you're going to put these in, tell us a little bit about, because it fits very nicely between my palms.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because it's really funny. One of the things that influenced people most in choosing a spirit is the look of the bottle.
Right.
It's pretty much one of the top things, even more with some people than the taste of it. Fortunately for us, the rum and the spirit itself is, you know, obviously incredibly important to us. But we spent a lot of time on the packaging so that people would, you know, maybe be curious about it. We really kind of went for this, and you'll see it if you meet us at the festival. It's more of a flat kind of canteen-like almost glass, right? And we wanted kind of an embossing on it. It looks a little weathered. Feels like, you know, you found it on a beach kind of thing with the soft kind of leathering, right?
Yeah, the way, even
but
though,
it fits really good in the hand. Mm-hmm. And we wanted it to be for bartenders, easy to grip, and also for, you know, the end consumer, people just enjoying it at home. So I'm glad you noticed that.
Simply put, every drop speaks true to the age declared on the top of the bottle. I love even this, like, I'm reading a story on the back of the bottle.
Yes, if you notice, we hand date and we hand bottle each one.
Yeah, I was noticing that too. I was like, that feels personal.
Yeah, that's the idea.
There you go. Well, it's nice handwriting, whoever put that
I have nothing to do with that. Pass it along next time I'm in Bogota.
Fantastic. Well, Jim, let's take a break here, and I want to let people know how they can find out more about you. Everyone go to therumlab.com for ticket information, and let's find out more about Parse Rum and where you can find where they're carried. More after this on 720 WGN. Big Pandy had joined us in studio, and he's got a whole month of comedy at the Comedy Bar, and this is after you did a whole month at the Zany's Comedy Club. of.
I know.
It's a month of, it's a, how many shows do they have a week at the Comedy Bar?
Comedy Bar, they actually have, I think it's 7 nights a week, but they don't do, like Zany's does headliners mm-hmm. every day now. Comedy Bar just does Friday through Sunday.
Excellent. And so how did it go? Have you finished the editing on your comedy special?
We are just about done. The trailer is actually out on our website now at teamuscomedy.com. We haven't really like pushed it yet. We're going to make a big social media push, but it's up there now because we wanted to update the site to make sure it, you know, it looks great. Turned out really well, so we're just excited to shop it around now.
Oh, very cool. And what have you been up to as far as, like, I know that you're getting the comedy special going and obviously booking gigs around town. What else are you working on right now?
So the other kind of big thing that I'm involved with is this web series called Code Switched. It's a local series here in Chicago, and we just got funded for our first season. So I'm one of the leads in it. It features a total South Asian cast, mm-hmm. and basically kind of their like everyday struggles and as they strive to make it. And they're all like millennials, but they have, you know, immigrant parents and things like that. So it does a good balance of playing both sides of, like, you know, these are kids, but they're also, you know, dealing with these immigrant strifes, you know. And we talked about this a little bit on the last time I was here.
Uh-huh.
So it's a really cool show. The pilot has gotten tons of acclaim and a lot of good press. So it got funded. They did an Indiegogo campaign, funded the first season, raised $25,000, completely independent, and they filmed the first half of the first season now, earlier this month, and they're going to film the rest next month.
Oh, how cool.
So hopefully that comes out in summer sometime, or Netflix buys it and I just become famous. That's the...
It's interesting because I was just talking to a comic at Zany's. We were in the green room talking about what is your measure of success, right?
And that's so, yeah, that's a great question, actually. I'm thinking about that more and more now.
I mean, like, there comes a point where, you know, not even there comes a point, but everyone has a different measure of it. For me, I remember when I, you know, knowing that I was still going to have a booking at a comedy club 6 months out or a year out was very exciting.
Yeah, that's huge when you don't have to worry about dates for a month, you know? That's a big thing.
Yeah, comedy is feast or famine. You'll have, like, your calendar full and it's exciting and everything, and then you see, oh my god, I have holes in my calendar. But do you still have a day job as well?
Yeah, I do. I was just telling Mike about the struggles in that, just because it's getting really busy there, and it's like comedy's getting busy, so it's right now it's able to balance it just because it's a startup, so like the hour's a little bit more flexible, mm-hmm. and they know I do this. It's not like I'm hiding the fact that I do comedy. I don't think I can hide it anymore, just my social media presence.
Sure.
it's like, oh, I'm at WGN at 1 a.m., but going into work at 8, like, it's not...
Hello.
Yeah, but no, it's definitely, I love it because it's kind of keeps me, I love being on a schedule. Like, I'm the most productive when I know I have to do something. Like, I feel like I need to get really disciplined in comedy before I can just take a departure from the 9 to 5, because I'm so used to like the rigors of the 9 to 5 that I'm like, oh, I got 2 hours between this gig, I'm going to write for an hour. Like, I'm good about that. But if I had nothing to do, I'd be like, I'll get to it. And
sure.
then I just show up at the show like after a nap. Like, that's, I feel like I'm very prone to do that if I don't have something going on during the day.
Interesting, because there is that, you know, the rigors of comedy are kind of self-determined, aside
from
like getting there, but you make your own rules because there aren't any, you know. And you'll hear comics say, oh, I make sure I write every single day for half an hour. Like, that, there's the story that Jerry Seinfeld
type, yeah.
Yeah, makes himself write every day. And then you have someone like Jay Leno who would say, I never wrote a joke down because if it's not good enough to remember, it's not good enough to tell. And so you have that wide array mm-hmm. of different approaches, you know.
And I'm finding as I like get more and more into comedy, like I'm a mix of both. Like, I'll have a couple days where I'll be writing, and mm-hmm. then I'll have a week where I just am performing and like adding tags on stage, but not remembering or writing any of them down.
Well, because a lot of times, you know, you get something on its feet and you find that, you know, you can put a theme on stage
and then your whole set. Exactly. Yeah. And it's weird because it's like, I don't want to be beholden to one, but it is kind of like the Seinfeld approach is like, that's his process and he knows it works. Like,
exactly.
It is kind of like, for me, I'm still figuring out what that process is, so it's sometimes frustrating, but it's also like exciting because I'm like, oh, maybe I'll just come up with an idea on stage and it'll flesh itself out over the, you know, over the course of the set.
I know. I remember driving to gigs and getting really like up to like anxious. I feel this anxiety coming up, worrying about like, do I have enough new material? Do I have this? Is this as honed as I want it to be? Especially when you're hosting a show, which you'll be doing for mm-hmm. April at the comedy bar. There's a certain kind of energy and difference to hosting a show as opposed to being.
Oh, totally different. Yeah.
You're the first man on the beach.
Yeah. You have no, and that's the thing that Zany's month was kind of nice, is because you have no like way of reading, like you can kind of read the audience, but until the first joke lands, like, you're not really doing, you're just like studying them, but it, that doesn't mean anything.
Oh yeah.
So you have no, like, the pleasure of being the second comic to be like, all right, that they don't like relationship stuff, let's talk about other stuff. Like, you have to figure that out. But also make it seem graceful and like that it's like seamless. Like, you don't want to give it away that you're testing jokes and being like, oh, this doesn't work. Like, I always start off probably with, not always, but like, I'll start off with either like some race stuff. Mm-hmm. And if they respond well, I'll be like, oh, cool, you guys like the race stuff up top. If they don't, I'm like, you guys didn't like race stuff up top. Like, I'll usually flip it, but it kind of like sets the tone of like, all right, we're going to talk about some stuff. Or like today, you know, it's not going to be this like fun, cute show. It's going to be some real stuff that people are going to get into.
Right. And that's the thing too, is that like a lot of hosts, some hosts are very skilled at working the crowd. And then you have to have that sort of ability to go back and forth. Because now you have to remind the audience, okay, now I've talked to you, now let's do material, because the rest of the comics will be doing material.
Yeah, and I'm finding that balance. Like, I think I was studying like people who are great at it, like all the Zany's hosts who've been doing it for like decades, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what do they do? Like, they always do, usually it's like a couple jokes up top, then into crowd work, then back to joke, end on jokes.
Right.
So it's like this formula of like, because I was like going out there like, oh, how's everyone doing? And like immediately, like, well, you got to earn their trust first. Right. Like, you got to be like, because I've hosted before, but it's different. I feel like for some reason at Zany's, it's so short. It's like your host set, feature, headliner.
Right.
But like at a show, you have so many more hosting opportunities because you're going up and in between comics and you're riffing between comics, like five or six of them. But at Zany's, it's like that's it. But it's a longer time period, but it's also like you can't retake that first impression on stage. Is like, if you mess that up, that's like, all right, well, that's cool. They're not going to see me for 20 minutes now, and I just ruined that. Like, I just had to sit in the fact that I ruined that, right? So I just started, like, I started realizing, I'm like, oh, I got to earn their trust with it. Like, a couple.
Yes.
And that's how I start my sets, too. Like, I try to get a laugh within, you know, 30 seconds or 20 seconds, and then I can kind of settle into the set. And it's right. The same thing with hosting.
Yeah, I agree. We're talking to Vic Pandya. He is going to be at the Comedy Bar all of April. So it's this week through the 29th of April. And that's Mondays and Fridays. Where can people go to your website or social media?
Social media. I'm on Instagram and Facebook at VP Comedy. And just Google the Comedy Bar for tickets there. But I'm there. I'm hosting the weekend, so Friday through Sunday.
All right. We can keep you one more segment before you have to go, because you got to get up early for work. More after this on 720 WGN. We are hanging out in the Allstate Showcase studio with comedian Vic Pandya. He's a day job, which there's a whole debate on social media between comics as to whether or not you should talk about your day job and things like that. But I want to ask Vic about tax season when it comes to his particular position in HR. Are there concerns that come up from people like with their taxes and like they have questions about like what they're supposed to claim and not claim or forms that they didn't get from you? What is that like at this time of year for you?
Yeah, it's luckily most of our stuff, like we have an HR like system that like automates a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. So like they can get their like papers online and stuff like that, and there's also like help information on there. So usually I have a pretty good like bank of stuff I can send them first, so I try to like just spam them with information of like in the right direction. Like,
sure.
If it's like a standard thing, like how do I get my like W-9 or whatever, like I'll find that for them. But if it's like something like I need to claim this person as a dependent, I'm like, dude,
oh boy,
why you make me do this? Like, I gotta research now. I gotta do my job. Like, I'm out here trying to coast. I gotta tell these jokes. No, but it's like I've been building up the kind of like FAQ on, you know, the standard question and response. And there's so much information now available online. And we actually have a financial advisor who kind of like helps people at our company. So like, mm-hmm. I always hit him up if I have, you know, really detailed questions. And I'm a finance major. I should know what I'm talking about.
Well, because we had David Hochberg on a few weeks ago, or maybe it was even just last week, who mentioned that if you're getting a refund of several thousand dollars, then you need to talk to your HR person about the, you know, how money is withheld in your taxes.
And this I was like, news to me.
I mean, I know. I didn't know I could go to HR. I mean, do you even know where our HR department is?
An office?
I know. I'm like, I don't know how to get a hold of those folks, and I don't even know what I'm supposed to ask.
Yeah.
But I always act as though, I guess when I have a refund, it just feels like bonus round for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, you're like, oh, cool, I just a few extra $100 I didn't know I had. And
don't you feel like you would spend it all year long if it didn't come in one bunch in April? Do you get a refund?
I do.
Yeah.
But it's not a lot.
Also, the frustrating thing with the refund, though, it's variable, right? Like, one year you could get like $100, next year you get like $1,000. So you can't plan for really like to spend it. It's just like a fun, like you said, it's an extra, just a little bonus.
I'm like, bonus round, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not, right?
No.
It's our money.
It's the money,
but
yes.
You, and that's how they trick you.
Because yes. It was yours in the first place.
I just become all, I'm like, and down with the government. Like, that's, that's what I'm really here to promote.
Well, that's Hochberg's point, is that you're letting the government have a certain amount of money every month that should be going directly to you.
To you, yeah.
Although if you do that, don't you sometimes have to pay at the end?
Yeah, exactly.
Because I did that once where I was getting more, and then in the end I had to pay.
Yeah, you're withholding. You didn't hold enough, so now you have to pay out. But that's exactly why they do it, is they take a little bit out that we don't feel it. Imagine they took all that money out at one time, you'd be like, I would never pay taxes again.
Oh, I remember one time I did a gig in L.A., and when I got my tax, because their taxes are higher, I was like, what? I'm never working in California again.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible.
That was
yeah.
painful.
Danny Callis has this really funny bit. You may know it. He was talking about he did a gig, I think it was in some state, and he's like, it was like $500 for the gig, and he's like, a couple-hour drive. He goes there, his like, car breaks down. All these like travesties happen along the trip. He's like, I got that $500 check when I picked it up. I got back to Chicago, had $23. Like, after
yes.
the net of all the taxes, all the other things, he was mm-hmm. like, he's like, and I'm a success in the comedy scene in Chicago. Like, it's great bit. So funny.
Well, and again, that goes to what determines whether or not you're a success in stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
Is it working consistently? You know, people think, oh, if you get a sitcom, or if you, you know, there's this idea that, oh, if I've never heard of you, or you haven't had an appearance on a late night show, then you're not. But it's kind of like anything else.
But there's
people
so many
doing the work.
Yeah, there's so many like people that you and I probably aspire to that people probably have never heard of, like people who are comic famous, you know, who are like in the scene famous. But yeah, I think everyone's got their different definition. Like, I know people now who are road comics. They work the road.
Oh yes.
They make like 40 to 50K a year doing the road, but they're headlining clubs, or like at least featuring regular clubs, and they're doing what they want to do, but no one would ever know their name.
Mm-mm.
But they love that, and that's what they want to do, and they're completely happy with that. But
well, and I know there are some of the funniest people I used to want to write a book called The Funniest Guys You Never Heard Of, because most of the people I worked with when I started out, they were all men. There were guys like Fred Klett. There are guys like Fred Klett, who was just a beast on stage. I mean, like, he would just destroy every single show consistently. And he got to a point where he was like, he would do all the showcases for like Letterman and for Leno, and he would be at the HBO showcases. He would go out and he would, and he just wasn't what they were looking for, whatever that was.
Yeah.
And he ended up doing cruises and then became a corporate comic and makes, you know, his living that way.
Which is actually very lucrative.
It's very lucrative. Well, yeah. Yeah, that's like Greg Schwemm, and that's like, and then there were road comics, like you mentioned, maybe making $50,000-$60,000 a year, like Patrick Spring, who I would work with in the middle of Nebraska, and just an unbelievable, like, just these funny guys, like fall on the floor funny guys.
Yep.
I remember when I first saw Brian Regan, and then of course Brian Regan took off in a different way, right? He had all of the Letterman appearances and obviously sells out theaters and does a great job, but not necessarily famous, you know. You'd still have to explain to people who he is.
Yeah, people have heard the name, but they don't really know why. Like, a lot of people don't know why, and that's because he's someone who's unique, because he's famous, but he's also like only a stand-up.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a show. He doesn't have all these other things. That's why mainstream is not. So to be like mainstream famous is like, you got to do all these other things. And it's like, yeah, do you want that? Or do you just want to get really good at stand-up and be a stand-up that people look up to and like? Everyone has their different goal. I think it's too early to say, like, I love stand-up. I always want to be doing, whatever I do, I want to always be able to do stand-up.
Right.
Whether that be, you know, something in acting, movies, whatever. But stand-up needs to be there as like the primary kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's funny with the day job. Like, I'm always thinking like, oh, what will I do after the day job? Do something full-time in comedy. But at the same time, I know it's going to be the same thing. I'll be doing whatever else during the day, and then I'll be doing stand-up at night, because it's like, now you do noon stand-up gigs unless you're a corporate comic.
Yeah, no.
So there will never be a point where you're not doing two things.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. And it's one of those things too now with Netflix having specials. And people wanting, a lot of comics are like trying to figure that nut out. I mean, there's a lot of different avenues for
being. Comedy Central is not like the go-to anymore.
No.
I mean, it's a way to do it, but there's so many other ways. Like, there's 15-minute Netflix specials now. Like, right. you can do a shorter than a feature set at Zany's and get a Netflix special, right?
It's the strangest thing. It is. But yeah, and then people always ask, you just are constantly showing up and trying to do the best for the audience and then finding your way with your career. But you've got a 401k, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, we were talking about that with Tyler on here last time. I know.
Yeah.
That's why the special, Friends with 401k Benefits, you know? And hopefully that lasts. I mean, I can still fund it after I go full-time comedy, but there's no money going to be going into that thing. It's just going to build on interest, hopefully, for the next 10 years or whatever it may be. But we'll see.
Yeah. Well, that's the you know, the beautiful thing about stand-up, though, is there's so many different ways to get it done. Now, have you been able to go out to Los Angeles and showcase out there?
I've done some shows out there. I haven't. When I went out there, it was like a year into comedy. I went there way too soon. And I'm starting to do more like the showcase, those ones now, just because like I'm more nuanced and have the connections now. But I'm trying to get an agent right now and then kind of plug myself into that because I still don't have one. So right now it's all been like past me being recommended or whatever it may be. So I need to really like get on top of that. And then I can get famous.
I'm curious to see how things are going to change in Hollywood, too, because I remember a couple of years ago when I was going out and my manager and I would do meetings and they would tell me about like how, you know, it would be really so much easier if you had 250,000 followers on Twitter or on, you know, Facebook. Yeah. And then you find out like how many people were buying followers.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a sort of bizarre sort of frenzy to, you know, then, you know, were people getting breaks because they were buying followers? You know what I mean? And that's never going to come back to bite them.
No.
It's just the nature of the beast.
It's like it's now like fake it till you make it. It's like that embodied. Like it's like how famous can you be on social media? Can you fill a club? Because people who book clubs only care about if you can fill a room.
Club. Yeah,
they don't care. I mean, they want you to be somewhat competent. But if you're like a draw, they'll book you. And then you have people who are doing 45 minutes who've never done more than 10 minutes on YouTube.
Right.
And then it's like the worst experience for everyone else involved.
Oh, no doubt about it.
Yeah. And there's I've heard horror stories of like that draw not coming through. And it's like, it's the funniest thing.
That happened once. I can't remember the guy's name. He was doing Zanies and they had me hosting for him. And I was like, who's this guy? And he was a YouTube. He'd done like a bunch of stuff about his being in dorms and stuff like that. And just didn't have the closing material.
Oh, yeah. And then it's like that you, and at Zanies too, it's like even more apparent because like you bring up a headliner, do 40 minutes to an hour, and it's like if they don't, within 10 minutes, you know, or 2 minutes, but you and I would know after 2 minutes, but it's like, oh God.
I had a headliner one time, and I'm not going to say her name, but I was at the Vernon Hills Zanies, and her first show was great, and I was the MC, and then her second show, she just struggled, and a half an hour in, she bailed, and I had to go fill the rest of the time. Oh. Fortunately, Zanies books headliners that also MC the show just for situations like that.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I was just like, okay, gonna come up here and do this.
Oh, there's so many funny, like, I think Vince was saying he was hosting for Tracy Morgan.
Yes.
Heard the story.
I don't know if we want to get into any details about Tracy Morgan destroying the bathroom during the middle of the set.
And he would run off the stage and Vince would have to go up and he'd be like, just get back on. And Vince would do like, did an hour? Because he would go up every like 10 minutes and while Tracy was in the bathroom.
One time I was on stage, I was a host, it was just a two-man show, me and Dave Attell. And we had done the Friday night show and I was pregnant. I think I was pregnant with my first child. It might have been my second. But Zanies in Vernon Hills had four double doors. It was a massive room. And the Friday night shows had gone great. And the next show, the next night they had moved the times up because we were going to be packed and they wanted to be able to turn the room over. So we started the first show at 7 o'clock, and I'm on stage and I am wrapping up, and I see, and they know I'm on my last joke, and I see every door in the club fly open and someone come to the stage and hand me a note: David Tell's not in the room yet, just vamp. And I had just done my top 20 minutes or 25 minutes. I mean, I was just starting to headline, but I was just like, and I had to vamp for 35 minutes.
That's
because
crazy.
He thought the show was at 8 o'clock,
the original time,
thinking that he had until 8:20
to
get
show
another,
up.
Yeah, yeah, that was
and comics are the worst. We'll show up a minute before I said.
I know. Cindy Nelson in Rosemont's just like, I have the text from the parking lot. I'm like, I'm here. I'm parking.
I just need my time. Like, I'll get in when I get in. I did that Zany's 40 thing yesterday, and I was like, I'll go on between groups 2 and 3. And I'm like, I'll arrive at 8:15. Right. I was like, I'll arrive when I arrive.
I know. I feel badly when the club starts to get nervous. Well, Vic, I know you've got to go to work tomorrow. We've been hanging out with Vic Pandya, and we look forward to having you back in studio. He's going to be at the Comedy Bar the rest of this month. And I'm sure he's got some gigs coming up at Zanies and other clubs around the city as well. And where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, check out teamuscomedy.com for all the shows that we produce. And then follow me on Facebook and Instagram at VP Comedy.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Get some rest. Well, you gotta get up early.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it.
Don't blow that gig. You need the 401k.
Definitely.
More after this on 720 WGN. Throughout the city of Chicago, there have been some pretty big field trips going on. I know today my son's class went to the Museum of Science and Industry, and I have been a chaperone on many field trips. I wonder how many of our listeners have done that and what your experience has been like. 312-981-7200. Have you ever chaperoned your child child's field trip. I mean, it would be weird if you chaperoned some other child's field trip. You can't just show up at those things. Although, speaking of which, I'm not putting this on social media because I don't want any of the parents from my son's class to say anything. But I am, in fact, leaving very early in the morning. In just a few hours, I'm going to fly to D.C. Esmeralda to stalk my son's field trip. So that's happening.
You use the word stalk.
Well, I don't know how else to put it because I'm not
visit
a company, but I'm not chaperoning.
Well,
I'm sort of stealthily going to show up. Yes. Keep.
Just so happened to be there.
Oh, you guys are at the Smithsonian? What were the chances? I don't know how many of the destinations I'm actually going to go to, but I'm partly going because he's going to be in D.C., but I'm also going to visit a friend of mine who works for the State Department. So that's going to, it's funny. Oh, I had this moment last week. I get a text from my friend who was like, hey, I got a table. Hope that's okay. Let me know when you're here. And that was from my friend in D.C. And I was like, I started having a panic attack. I was like, was I supposed to be there today?
And she's been like, hold that for next week.
I know. I told her, I was like, I'm so sorry, sweetie. I'm not coming until next week. I'm sure it was my fault. I'm sure that there's some text because it wasn't the first time I've gotten a text like that. I probably said, hey, next Wednesday or whatever, and at whatever date. So yeah, she was bummed because she said that she was so excited that she had gotten off work early. She was ready to catch up with me. We haven't seen each other in a couple of years, but she works for the State Department, and I've never really shared too much about the messages she has sent me over the last year. She has been there since about 2011, so she's been through the Obama administration and now during the Trump administration, and has shared some of her concerns about the transition and things that have happened since then. But to help her with her anonymity, I'm not going to go into too much detail about that. So I will be in D.C. Hang out with her. I've been to D.C. before. I've been to the Capitol, so I'm not going to suddenly show up at one of those destinations on Griffin's trip. But I've been to pretty much every single field trip that he has been on since he was 3 years old. So this would be one of the first big trips I would have missed.
Wow.
I know.
So why? What?
What? Why have I done all the other ones?
Wait, you have been?
I've been on almost every single one except for one of the dunes. Because of this job, I couldn't take the night off.
Ugh, take a vacation from them.
I'm essentially going on this one. I told Griffin, I'm like, if you don't like the food, just let me know and I will I'll get something from Subway for you. And so I was thinking maybe I dress up like as a food delivery person and just like he's ordered something at the Smithsonian.
Oh, I'm sure he'll love that.
He was appalled at first, and I think because I was kind of just making it funny, because I asked him, I said, hey, I'm only a couple stops down from you and where you're staying in your hotel, so let me know when you guys are lining up for the train. He goes, I will do no such thing, Mommy. He's like, this is your adventure.
Although I do love that he still says mommy.
He says mommy.
That just cracks me up because it's like, no, Mommy.
I will say this. When he was younger, he used to say mama. Which freaked me out. He sounded like a little He sounded like a little French boy.
That's so proper.
Mama. It was very proper. Did you have good field trips when you were in grade school or high school?
Yes.
Right?
I never got to go. I never went anywhere far. I don't think I was ever in whatever class or club or whatever got to go to places overnight because I never got to do that.
You never had to do the overnighters?
Mm-mm.
I did we went to Springfield and I remember that being fun. I think we only went for one night. My biggest memory of going to Springfield was the smorgasbords. I'd never been to a smorgasbord before and there used to be a lot of smorgasbords.
Ooh.
And I had frog legs for the first time when I was in Springfield for my eighth grade trip.
Yeah, I never did that. I mean, the ones I remember is Physics Day, where you would go to Six Flags.
Yes, we did that one too.
And you would do work, but I wouldn't.
I'd always just do
it on the bus.
We didn't do the work either. I don't remember turning anything
in. I'd be like, that was like 17 inches or whatever the circular thing was, right? Whatever.
Something momentum.
Yeah.
I think that all my memories of our field trips revolved around what food I got to eat. Like when we went to the Symphony Orchestra of Chicago, we would go to Sears Tower and they have this food court that was like food around the world. Like that was my favorite part. I mean,
we never did it. I mean, we always had kind of pretty lame field trips. So it was always like bag lunch.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that was the thing because I never really brought lunch.
Yeah, me neither.
So it was a whole to-do at my house. Like, we had to go get chips or we had to go get for sandwiches because I never did that. I never took lunch. I would always just buy hot lunch.
I was never a fan of the bag lunch. Something was always going to get smushed or warm.
You try to keep your soda cold.
Right.
It never works out.
And the apple's like brown when you bite it. You're like, it's like powdery.
Yeah. I remember going, like, we did the, what I call now the tree museum.
The tree museum?
The arboretum.
In
it was like a tree museum. Okay. If you think about it.
Sure. That makes sense.
We did, what is it called? Contigny or?
Mm-mm, not familiar.
It's an army place.
Okay.
I forget what it was.
It's like an army history museum?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Military museum?
Yeah, those are the ones I remember going to.
Wow, look at that. Tanks.
Yeah.
Here's a cannon.
It was very exciting.
It sounds like exciting.
I know we did one where we had to do activities,
mm-hmm.
you know, like team building stuff.
Didn't you ever get to go to the Museum of Science and Industry?
Not with school.
No.
I don't think so.
I did chaperone last year. Now, Michael, have you been, when you were a kid, did you enjoy the field trips with your school?
Ooh, just like Esmeralda, I was in the same kind of boat. I went to a very small private Catholic school, and they didn't really let us out.
Suburbs are just boring.
Yeah, they didn't let us out very often.
Really? They didn't let you out?
We did go to the Domino's Pizza Place to learn how to make a pizza one time.
What?
That was kind of cool.
See, that's cool.
Did you get to go to Cantigny or whatever it was? It was like an army place.
Oh, so many memories. No, we did not go.
You did not go to Cantigny?
But I did. When I grew up, I was a camp counselor, and these students that we were counseling mm-hmm. went to all the best places. We went to Great America.
Yep.
We went to all the museums everywhere, and that was kind of cool. But since I was the teacher, it wasn't as fun because I didn't get to play with, you know, the ball that, like, makes your hair stand up and everything, the lightning.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, you didn't get to go to Six Flags for Physics Day?
No, Physics Day.
Yeah. The auspice of doing physics.
I heard tall
tales. Yeah, that was always like the best day ever.
I only heard the fairy tale stories about that back in eighth grade.
Did you take physics?
I did take physics, but high school, yeah. I know. My class wasn't as hip.
Yeah, that's what it is, right?
Come on, Marion Central, I'm calling you out right now.
Oh man, see that's why you need to do adult field trips. Although I guess we're just adults, we can go wherever we want.
Yeah, isn't that just
going places?
Yeah.
Doesn't have the same ring to it.
I wanted for such a long time to do a field trip, an adult field trip to, although that sounds naughty, but a field trip to Springfield and show people around the Capitol because, you know, maybe you went when you were in eighth grade, but it's all a blur and you haven't met your legislators and go to the Abraham Lincoln House.
That would be very much like a field trip.
It would be a field trip.
You would have to have it very planned.
Yes.
To be a field trip.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, that's one of the things. I'm kind of glad I'm not one of the chaperones on this D.C. trip because, and the last one I went to, we were at Navy Pier for the Griffin's class was at the Navy Pier for the Shakespeare Theater. They were doing Romeo and Juliet, and the Romeo and Juliet cast was there were some, you know, traditionally there, you know, roles that might have been played by men in the past were being played by women, and you had a wide variety of representation in the cast. It was a great production, and they also did a Q&A at the end of it, and one of the boys in the class, because, you know, there's a very mischievous nature to a lot of Shakespeare's writing, and so the way they interpreted it was, you know, the kind of singing and dancing. And one of the girls kind of did a very ribald, sort of a little bit risque dance movement. And one of the classmates from Griffin's class raised his hand. He was the first one to ask a question. He goes, "So how did it feel bumping and grinding your butt in front of all these people?" And before she said anything, he was like going around and like high-fiving all of his friends because people in the theater were laughing.
Oh.
And I gave him a talking to, and then I went after we were done, and then I went to the school counselor who was along with us for the field trip, and I was like, is this really how you want the school to be represented at one of these events? Is this something that we're not going to say anything about? And I'm not saying it's my fault, but he may or may not have been expelled within about a week or two. Not because of that field trip. There were other extenuating factors, but I find that I don't have the patience for the 12 and 13 year old group anymore. The 3 to 5 year olds, like, they're still in awe of things, and it's like herding cats, but at the same time, you know, as long as you don't lose one, you're doing a good job as a chaperone.
Mm-hmm.
I guess. I don't know.
Man, yeah, I remember those days where you just try to get a rise out of people, so.
Oh, so appalling. Well, great. What was crazy about it was then the kids could choose which group of kids they wanted to be with for like the rest of the day at Navy Pier.
Ooh.
And the kid that I chewed out wanted to be in my group. I don't know if he like maybe wasn't getting like guidelines and like structure at home, and he liked being I didn't yell at him, but I gave him a I gave him.
Isn't that a thing? Children crave structure and discipline.
But man, as I spent the rest of that day going, don't slide down the banister. Do not shoplift in this store. Don't jump in the lake. I mean, so I kind of got my.
Oh, I can't deal with that. I'd be like, go jump in the lake. Go on. See what happens. Lesson learned.
So this is why I am I'm just attaching myself. We're not even leaving from the same airport. So Griffin is going off with. I'm not going to be in the same hotel. Griffin was very happy that we're not going to be staying at the same hotel. I'm going to be in the same neighborhood. Yeah, I'm not saying I'm not doing a strange thing, but for whatever reason, this is his first time. I know, I'm crazy. I have a friend in D.C. who I'm staying with, but I said, Griffin, if you need anything, I'll be around, but I'm not going to be a chaperone. I did not volunteer for this. Although I kind of wonder if they would have banned me from it too. Maybe they wouldn't have let me just from my previous experience. And besides, as the last time I went on an overnight trip with his class, they made me get a tuberculosis test and fingerprinting background check. And when I went into my doctor's office to get the TB test, she said, you know, it's been a while since you've been here. Why don't we do a full exam? I had to get a pap smear for my son's field trip. That seems excessive.
Although that's kind of a nice way to like remember,
I guess.
Like, oh, field trip time. Got to get that pap smear.
Got to get my pap smear. And so that was another reason I didn't want to be a volunteer to be a chef.
Another pap smear? You were worried? It's like too many.
I had mine last year. Let's take a break here. 312-981-7200. Oh, by the way, we did get a text as it's Cantini.
Cantini?
Cantini. Cantini. Yes.
I remember many, 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 many years ago.
Yeah, I'm sure there are places I went that I can't remember either. But I'll think about that during the break. More after this on 720 WGN. Field trips are a great way to explore the community around you. And it sounds as though Esmeralda and Michael, maybe your schools, you know, you went with what was in the area. But I had no idea, Esmeralda, that the Robert R. McCormick House was in Cantini.
Yeah, neither did I.
And
apparently. With
The family that made the Chicago Tribune, the world's greatest newspaper, thereby, I guess, also birthing us. Well, that sounds weird, but birthing WGN. Interesting. I have to find that house. The McCormick House is part of, they have preserved and managed and restored the Robert R. McCormick Cantini home to tell his story through a robust program of educational services that connect his life and legacy to field trip to Cantini.
I remember it was pretty. Like the grounds were gorgeous.
It looks beautiful. So one of our friends, Tracy, says from Hinsdale that, by the way, for me, it was a great way to see the city. Some of the places my parents did take me to, others they might not have taken me to. But someone writes, school field trips are exciting to take the kids to. I went on field trips when I was little to the Museum of Science and Industry, Lincoln Park Zoo, Shedd Aquarium, Adler Planetarium. I take my little nieces and nephews on their school field trips to share the experiences I had. That's nice. On my eighth grade trip from Catholic high school, we went to D.C. Kind of fun, as I recall. Back in 1959, my older son went to Germany for his high school senior trip, and my daughter went on her senior trip to Hawaii. I have two framed pictures from her that she blew up for me back then, hanging on my walls right now. Wow, to this day. I did not go anywhere outside of the... Springfield was the only out-of-town field trip I ever went with schools. There are kids like doing international trips in high school. Michael is astounded, just shaking his head at that idea.
Yeah, that does not exist in my world at the moment. That's not in my wheelhouse.
No, I don't even think my parents would let me.
Mm-mm.
Wow.
I went to NIU one time for a theater camp when I was young, and I think that was the farthest I've ever traveled as far as summer camps or field trips or anything. Yes.
I did Girl Scout camp every single summer. I loved Girl Scouts camp. Girl Scout camp? Were you a summer camp kid?
I stayed in my house.
Well, see, Griffin really hated it. He did summer camp for a couple summers and just hated it. Finally, he asked us, he goes, please don't make me go anymore. He did not. not like it at all. And I wish he had tried like away camp maybe once. But I mean, like, if you're not made for it, if it's not your thing. By the way, now we're getting texts as to how to pronounce. Now someone's writing us Cantigny. So now we're getting all kinds.
Oh, boy.
Just so
tomato,
you know,
tomato?
Just so you know, 708, the previous texter corrected us to Cantini. And so we are. Michael, can you check with Google and type in Cantigny and see if we get a pronunciation so that we can perhaps settle this? Unless we get a, it can be pronounced this way and or that way.
Has to be a proper way. I think it's because it's a name. It's someone's name,
right? Cantigny.
So much I learned from that field trip.
And is this near? Is this like out in the western suburbs?
I think so. What did I?
Do you have a
Wheaton? I think it said.
Oh, is it? Do we have a pronunciation for our listeners' edification as well as mine?
Cantigny.
What?
Oh man.
Cantigny.
Cantigny. Oh, that's real fancy.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and say that both of our textures then are incorrect. Cantigny.
Wheaton, by the way. It isn't Wheaton.
It's, oh, there you go.
Cantigny.
Everybody's wrong. Unless you're saying Cantigny. Sounds like he's saying we at the end.
Cantigny. Cantigny.
Oh, Cantigny.
It's very French.
One more time. I don't want to.
Cantigny.
It is. It's a village in North France, south of Armines. First major battle of the U.S. forces in World War I happened on May 1918 is when it happened.
We're getting another text from the 630. We live near Cantigny.
Cantigny.
The G is silent. We're getting that part of it, but is it? But then, I mean, then it could be anything. Cantigny. Well, now we're going to get phone calls just
we're
for
just going to say that park.
Hey, look, I had a lot of trouble when I was in college for my friends who were from Joliet. They were like, because I would say Joliet, and they would get I know.
It's Joliet.
It's Joliet.
It is Joliet.
So we're clear on that. Here we have, we have Patrick, who would like to give us another pronunciation of this area in the Chicagoland.
It's Cantigny.
It's what?
Wait, what?
Cantigny.
Cantigny?
That would be now the fourth pronunciation.
I'm going to go no on that one.
The 630 says the G.
It is.
You're making the N. You're making you're making the N silent.
Ladies, Google says Cantigny.
Google says Cantigny.
Cantigny.
Right. And that's because it's pronunciating it from the French version. We're in America. Cantigny.
Cantigny.
Okay.
Hey, I love Patty.
Hi, how you doing, Patrick? All right, so
whatever. I'm just saying, as far as being from when I was a kid at 11, we went there. They called it Cantigny.
We're getting a lot of we're getting
not Cantigny, Cantigny.
Right. So, but I'm just letting you know that texters are also texting and saying, you're wrong, Patty. It's Cantigny. And then another person saying it's Cantigny.
Yeah. Or Cantigny. It depends who you talk to. Because I remember as a kid, a lot of people, I don't know why, but at that point, it was a big place to go. And it was either Cantigny or Cantigny.
Is that the last time you heard that name being said?
Oh, we have the voicemail. We're gonna call up. We're gonna get this settled because Michael's gonna be able to get a recording on the air.
Cantigny.
All right. Now we're getting. Oh, we have a can't. Wait a minute, Patrick. You're saying it's Cantigny.
Cantigny. Cantigny. But it's like you kind of don't pronounce the knee part.
All right. Hold on 1 second, Patrick. Michael's gonna
information. Press 1 for memberships, concert tickets, program registration, scout camping, or group reservations, press 2.
Oh, boy.
For the Cantigny shop, press 3.
Oh, listen to that. That's the Cantigny shop right there at the, right there, Patrick. That's the place of business right there. Is it the golf club? Is that what you did there? So the Cantigny golf club pronounces it Cantigny. So there you go. All right. That's, and now someone from the 224 says they golf there all the time. So, and I love that everyone's jumping on. See what you started, Esmeralda?
I just said it.
I know.
And I was even I wasn't even sure.
Right.
Cantigny.
There was a period of time when our friend Davide in Italy, we spent an entire evening trying to figure out how to pronounce his name. I hope Davide is listening in Italy and appreciates that we can't even pronounce the communities in our own area right here in Illinois. So there we go. Bam. 219 says, bam, with the audio recording. More to this on 720 WGN. Continue. Since I am taking the next couple of nights off, I want to make sure that we gift some people with some fun prizes. And Michael Heidemann has come up with a game called Lala Band or Contagious Disease. Lala, of course, is coming up in just a few months. When the band names were announced, Michael went through them and decided that perhaps there was some fun to be had with some of these names. And to see if you could tell if these names that I'm going to read for you are band names that are appearing at Lala, Lollapalooza, or if it is a contagious disease. So there's some of these things you might not want to catch, whether the band or the contagious disease. I have as our prizes, we have a Lumilani's gift certificate. We also have a desktop indoor weather station brought to you by American Weather Makers, Heating and Cooling, the 60 Minute Men, and of course, Lumilani's, the home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40 plus Chicagoland locations or order online at lumilnatis.com. 312-981-7200. The first two callers to call in can compete for these prizes. We'll let the winner pick which one they want, and we'll do it that way. So 312-981-7200. And while we wait for our contestants to ring in, I do want to find out if Esmeralda, did we determine if you already filed your taxes?
I filed federal. I still got to finish off Illinois.
Oh, right, because they charge an extra, like if you're doing
right.
it electronically.
It's like $12 or something.
I know. I feel the same way. I'm like, I can just mail this myself.
Yeah, I mean, it's just inputting the numbers, so it's nothing
right.
difficult. I can do it myself.
Can I ask if you got a refund?
Yeah. It's not a lot. I got like $200.
That's something though.
Wah, wah.
What are you going to do with the money?
I immediately put it towards my emergency fund.
See? That's smart.
It was, yeah.
Because I have a list in front of me about like things not to do. Although I'm afraid about reading one of these because I think that Michael has done this in the past. Some people really want to invest in cryptocurrency, and I
thought it was over.
I thought it was over too.
I thought something happened and now it's gone.
I don't think it's over. It's not over. So Michael's taking the calls from our listeners who want to compete with. We're gonna play Lala Band or Contagious Disease. So we're gonna take Rosalie is our first contestant. Hey Rosalie, how are you doing tonight?
I'm fine tonight. How are you?
Very well. Have you had a chance to look over the list of bands that will be appearing at Lollapalooza this summer?
No, I haven't.
That's okay. I mean, here's the thing is that you just based on the names, I'm going to have you tell me if you think it is a band or a contagious disease, okay?
Okay.
All right, I'm going to put Lance on the air too. Rosalie, where are you calling from?
Arlington Heights.
Oh, from Arlington Heights. You know, I'm going to be at the Metropolis Theater over there on April 20th.
Oh.
Doing one of my shows. So if you happen to be... I'm in the Daily Herald. There was an article about me today.
Oh, okay.
Talking a little bit about the show. Hey, Lance, how are you doing tonight?
Hello.
Hi, Lance. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Very good. Have you been to Lollapalooza in the past?
I have not.
All right. So maybe you're not familiar with... I'm not familiar with any of these bands, by the way. You're both starting from scratch, so this will be fun. So, Rosalie, I'm going to go with you first, all right? Tell me if you think this is a Lala band or a contagious disease.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is... Boogie with a Hoodie.
A Lala Band.
It is a Lala Band. Excellent. Mm-hmm. So one for Rosalie. Put that down on the board. Okay, Lance, yours is next. Do you think this is a Lala Band or a contagious disease? Gashi.
Disease.
I'm sorry. It is a Lala Band. Oh, no. It's right there. Okay, Rose. It's all right. I know it's such a desperate sound, isn't it? All right, here's one. All right, here we go, Rosalie. Do you think this is a Lala Band or a contagious disease? We have porphyria.
A contagious disease.
You say it like you know what it is. She's like,
well, I know it's a contagious disease.
Porphyria. It's purple urine. Is it because you knew that King George III may have suffered from it?
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
It leads.
Everyone knows that.
Everyone knows that part. I don't know if it's contagious, though. It's at least definitely a disease. All right. We're going to go to, okay, so Rosalie's got two, and Lance, it's your chance to start catching up here. Is it a Lalaband or a contagious disease? Vera Blue.
Lalaband.
It is a Lalaband. Lance has one on the board. All right, let's go here. So it's 2-1. All right, now here, Rosalie, we're gonna go to best of three. So if you get this third one, you're gonna get the you're gonna get your choice of prizes. We're both gonna win something. So hold on a second.
Okay.
All right. Do you think it's a Lalaband or a disease? Alien hand syndrome.
Contagious disease.
It is. It's a very bizarre for some. Hands with minds of their own that move and behave seemingly independent of the sufferer's intentions. The alien hands can undo buttons. Yeah, that's what my boyfriend in high school said. No, it's alien hand syndrome. I have a disease.
You see, you dated someone with a disease.
All right, Rosalie, you hold on the line. You get the first choice if you want the Lou Malnati's pizza or the weather system from our friends at. Don't go anywhere, Lance. You're gonna get the second prize. Whatever Laura Lee turns down, that will be your prize. All right, so hold on. Thank you both for playing. Rosalie playing Lalaband. I have Gilmore Girls stuck on my mind. Rosalie gets first choice, Michael. So let her know she gets a pick between Lou Malnati's or the desktop indoor weather station from our friends at American Weather Makers. Okay, I do have another prize. It's just Susie on the line. Susie's going to play by her. She's going to play alone. Hey, Susie, how are you doing tonight?
Very good.
Now, have you looked at the Lalaband list?
No, I haven't.
And by the way, neither have I. But it's not cheating if you had. I feel like you're going to get any trouble for cheating. All right. Tell me if it's a Lalaband or it, and you need to get. Let's say we'll go with three of these. All right, Susie.
Oh yeah, I'll do it.
All right. Lalaband or disease? Likey Lee.
Band.
It is a band. Wow. She's got so much confidence on that one. All right. She's got one. Let's see. The next one is Exploding Head.
Band.
It's a disease.
Continue.
Ooh.
It is, if the jarring sound of an explosion wakes you up in the middle of the night, it's usually because a transformer has blown or your cat knocked something over. But for some people, hearing such sounds is an everyday occurrence and it's all in their heads. That must be so frightening. You think that something has exploded, but it's just a sound in your head.
And you were sound asleep, yeah.
Exactly. Such incidents are thought to be brought on by anxiety or extreme fatigue. And there you go. So that's... Hey! That was you, right? You pushed a button, didn't you?
What button? I didn't hear anything.
It wasn't me.
What are you talking about?
All right, here's the next one for you, Susie. The next one is let's see, Gerbo. G. Herbo.
Contagious disease.
It's also a Lalaband.
Oh, no.
Michael put together a very good list. All right, I have one more. If you can get this one, we'll give you a desktop weather system, okay?
You got it.
All right, this one is Super Organism.
Lalaband.
It is. There you go.
Oh, good.
See, now that's the one that derailed this game several weeks ago because I thought that I was basically reading it with the end silent in the middle. So,
so was I, and I wasn't reading it.
See, Michael, some of us are we have goals, we have life goals, Michael, and that was one of them for us. All right, so I have a desktop indoor weather station for you, brought to you by American Weather Makers Heating and Cooling, the 60-Minute Men. Thank you for playing, Susie, Lance, and Rosalie, and hold on the line, Michael, we'll get your information for that.
Thanks very much.
Of course, thank you, Susie. So again, we will be back on Friday night. We're going to take a break here and come back and tell me something good. What are you smiling about? What makes you happy today? And then we'll catch up with what's going on Friday night. More after this on 720 WGN.